This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following program was homecrafted and recorded on October 19th. Good evening and welcome to a special edition of Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening, we depart from our usual format in order to share portions of a panel discussion that was held last week at UT, titled Proposition A in the Context of Race and Policing in Austin, Texas, an Urgent Forum. The event was jointly sponsored by the UT Department of Religious Studies and the Institute for Historical Studies in the Department of History. We are grateful to Courtney Meador for her work in organizing the event and for providing the audio. The moderator is Brent Crossan, Associate Professor in the UT Department of Religious Studies. He will be providing full introductions for each of the speakers, but we'll be hearing from Monica Munoz-Martinez, UT Associate Professor of History, Andrew Bush, faculty member at Coastal Carolina University, Gabriela Torres, and Ashley Hamilton from Communities of Color United, Jason McDonald, faculty member at Truman State University, and Elliot Treader, research fellow in the UT Department of Geography and Environment. Let's turn it over to Brent Crossan.
My name is Brent Crossan. I'm Associate Professor of Religious Studies at UT Austin. And I'm really pleased to welcome you all to this amazing panel that is put together on this occasion of these elections and Proposition A that's on the ballot currently in our early voting. And so I don't work in Austin. I work mostly outside the U.S., but I've been really lucky to, through colleagues in history and through people that are on this panel, to put together this number of people who are experts on Austin and Texas history and the present and future of what's going on with reimagining public safety in Austin. So I'm going to give a brief synopsis, and then I'll introduce the panelists, and they'll each have about 5 to 10 minutes. And I'll just deliver a very brief synopsis that I was helped to write by organizers who have been working on the ground in Austin. So thanks, first of all, to Courtney Meador and Institute of Historical Studies and to Religious Studies and to Kathy Mitchell, who is the main organizer who helped me to write the following synopsis of the lead up to the Proposition A currently on the ballot in early elections that this panel will discuss. I'll briefly read the synopsis to contextualize the present concerns that motivate this convergence of historians, geographers, and community organizers who work in and on Austin. So catalyzed by the deaths of George Floyd and others in the summer of 2020, protests against racialized police violence in Austin and around the world crystallized a broadly supported movement to either reform or reimagine public safety. In addition, the support was also galvanized by concrete incidences of police violence inflicted on these protesters with less lethal weapons in Austin in 2020. In Austin, city council members took this opportunity to address some longstanding problems with the police department here, like lawsuits against the police academy by former cadets, scandals over failure to investigate sexual assault, a DNA lab closed by state regulators as unsalvageable, and deaths of mentally ill people at the hands of police with no training in mental health. City Council temporarily closed the police academy in order to reform it and eliminated empty positions that couldn't be filled. The money saved was used to hire medics and launch a reimagined public safety process that included old and new ideas. The troubled forensic lab was finally made independent. 911 dispatch was moved out from under police supervision to better serve all public safety departments. And a task force was created to consider alternatives to police for various problems that could be better addressed by different kinds of staff. Against these efforts to differently fund or to even reimagine public safety, defunding the police became a rallying cry for an aggressive backlash led by GOP activists, the police unions, and in Austin by the PAC, Save Austin Now. Governor Abbott signed HB 1900, prohibiting cities from ever lowering police budgets and forcing Austin to place the funds for forensics, 911 dispatch, and other services, which were never actually defunded, back under the authority of the police department. The budget of the police was also raised to an unprecedented level by the city over and above what the governor had required, with an additional $10 million in the current budget. Under HB 1900, any increase in the city's police budget can never later be reduced. Austin now spends more per capita on police than any other Texas city. Subsequently, the recently formed PAC Save Austin Now, in concert with other groups, brought a ballot measure to recriminalize unhoused people last spring. The so-called camping ban passed and prohibits laying down in public at any time or asking for help after 7 p.m. within a certain radius of downtown and UT. After this victory, Save Austin Now quickly moved on to a different proposition, the Prop A that this panel will discuss. Prop A would mandate, if passed in the elections that are currently going on, a dramatic increase in funding for traditional policing in Austin. Save Austin Now, co-founder and chairman of the Travis County Republican Party, says Prop A addresses imminent safety concerns and needs. Opponents point out that such a dramatic funding increase would require cutting a host of other public services, including public safety services such as paramedics, firefighters, and mental health services, and that this massive expenditure could never be reversed under Governor Abbott's current prohibition against any city in Texas decreasing police budgets over the previous years. So this is the present context of this panel, and I want to now introduce this really wonderful group of panelists who will comment upon how both the history of Austin and Texas and the current situation informs how we're to understand Proposition A and what we can do in terms of reimagining public safety. So first of all, we have Monica Munoz Martinez, who is an associate professor of history at the University of Texas, Austin, and author of The Injustice Never Leaves You, Anti-Mexican Violence in Texas. She is also the primary investigator for Mapping Violence, Racial Terror in Texas, 1900 to 1930, a digital project that recovers histories of racial violence in Texas, as well as founding member of the award-winning nonprofit Refusing to Forget. And if that's not enough, she recently won the prestigious MacArthur Genius Award. So please welcome Monica Munoz Martinez.
I am so glad to be joining this conversation and providing information as a historian. I'm thankful to the institutes and the departments that are sponsoring this conversation so that we can have a dialogue. So I'm going to try to keep my comments today really on the shorter side. I'm looking forward to hearing from the other panelists. As was said, I'm a historian of racist violence in Texas during the Jim Crow era in the early 20th century, when laws and policies were put in place to restrict the rights of Black, Mexican, Indigenous, and Asian people in Texas and women. It's a period where we saw the rollback of voting rights and a whole set of civil rights, but also reproductive rights. And so it's a telling moment to be thinking about our current conversation with this history of the early 20th century in mind. The early 20th century was also a time period of brutal violence by mobs, but also by law enforcement. And so this included sheriffs across the state of Texas, local law enforcement, people that were deputized to become a part of the police forces in local communities across the state, but also by the Texas Rangers, by the state police force. And for most of history, it's a history that's been disavowed or hidden or worse, celebrated. And so we are really living with a culture, a society that has been taught to celebrate law enforcement and policing as a practice of social control for the good of communities and for public safety, without thinking about the consequences of the brutal policing practices, especially that were used as a form of social control, targeting Black and brown bodies. So What I've been interested in is not only recovering cases of specific cases of police violence, but also the long histories of people in Texas, in Austin, and across the state to call for police reform, to call for accountability, and to end cultures of impunity that were enjoyed by police and law enforcement when they committed acts of violence against people. In some cases, you know, these were complicated cases of, you know, shootouts and trying to get to the bottom of who shot first. But many of the cases that I study from the early 20th century were actually very clearly examples of extralegal violence. Prisoners being murdered in police custody, Texas Rangers colluding with local residents to organize massacres. The Borderneed Massacre in 1918 in West Texas is one of the most now more popularly known cases of Texas Ranger violence. But one of the details of that case that is troubling as a historian, if we think about context and long legacies, is that the Texas Ranger who was the captain of that police force, of that Texas Ranger company in West Texas, his name is James Monroe Fox. And he actually started his career working in law enforcement here in Austin and in Travis County. And one of the earliest records of his name appearing in historical archives is a case of him shooting a prisoner in his custody, an African-American man here in Austin. And so thinking about police violence and thinking about extra-legal violence in Texas, it's important for us to remember that these are histories that are interconnected and that there have been long calls for police reform. So one of the examples that is important for us to turn to is the 1919 investigation into Texas Rangers that was led by a state representative from South Texas named Jose T. Canales, who was the only, at the time, the only member of the Texas legislature who was Mexican-American. Although he identified as Mexican, he was very patriotic in aligning himself with the United States. When he led an investigation into Texas Ranger abuses, he came under investigation himself because he was identified as having Mexican origins. And so this investigation into Texas Ranger abuses in 1918 was an incredibly significant moment. It resulted in weeks of testimony, people coming to testify about abuses that they had suffered, to talk about events like the Borderneed Massacre. Evidence was submitted of crimes committed by Texas Rangers, often colluding with local law enforcement across the state. But the Texas congressman in that era, a joint committee, actually refused to implement some of the basic forms that were recommended by Canales in a bill called House Bill 5, which included putting Texas Rangers under bond, prosecuting Texas Rangers that had committed abuses, and removing from the Ranger force Texas Rangers that had committed crimes. What the committee decided to do was actually to justify abuse by the Texas Rangers. It did drastically reduce the force, but Texas Rangers who had records of violence were not prosecuted. Instead, many of them continued and had long careers in law enforcement by joining police departments across the state. James Monroe Fox was one of these Texas Rangers who moved to different counties and law enforcement, but they also joined forces like to create the U.S. Border Patrol. And so what we really saw was this moment where there was a possibility to change policing cultures and for the state of Texas to demand accountability. And instead, what the failure to hold police and state police accountable in 1918 meant that cultures of violence continued and they permeated throughout law enforcement. And actually, as a result, in 1919, then Governor Hobby continued to use the Texas Rangers to intimidate civil rights organizers, labor organizers, anti-lynching organizers, and specifically to target NAACP chapters across the state. So, you know, this is one example that I turn to when thinking about earlier efforts to change the culture of policing and to hold accountable police for extralegal acts of violence or things like murdering people in police custody. But it's also important to think about the long history of governors and local communities using law enforcement to intimidate people calling for social justice and civil rights. And so the Texas Rangers continue to be a law enforcement agency that was used to intimidate people across the state, African-American, Mexican-American communities, working to desegregate schools, for example. In the 1950s, in the 1960s, in the 1970s, there were also too many cases to mention of Texas Rangers committing acts of violence against labor organizers in South Texas and in East Texas in the 1960s and 70s. And of course, people, as Jose de Canales, was intimidated and threatened by law enforcement for bringing charges against the Texas Rangers. Throughout the 20th century, we also saw histories of people being intimidated when they called for at least accountability. So, you know, I'm happy to talk in more detail about what that looked like throughout the 20th century, but I also did want to bring for our conversations here in Austin to think about the long history of African-American, Mexican-American community organizers working towards changing voting practices in the state of Texas, but also in Austin specifically. So I think about the long effort, multiracial coalitions coming together in 1960s and 1970s to replace voting at large in Austin, to having district representation so that Mexican-American and African-American community members could actually influence things like city council elections. Whereas in other places, other towns and cities in Texas, some communities were able to change voting practices, those regulations, to have more impact on city council elections. In Austin, that didn't come about until 2014. Historians have looked at, sociologists have looked at the ways in which at-large voting for things like city councils and mayors intentionally disenfranchised racial and ethnic minorities. And so in Austin, people who have studied the proposition in 2014 to actually change how city council elections are run in Austin have questioned, is this actually going to lead to a more multiracial democracy? And so we are now in a moment asking, I think we have to ask about these propositions within that context of actually trying to, in many ways, undermine change that we've seen happen in city council representation that in Austin is still quite new. So I'll stop there and I look forward again to answering questions, but most especially hearing from the other panelists.
Great. Thanks so much, Professor Martinez. Next up, we have Andrew Bush, who is an interdisciplinary historian and assistant professor at Coastal Carolina University. He is author of City in a Garden, Environmental Transformations and Racial Justice in 20th Century Austin, Texas, and his new project, High Tech Texas, Public Institutions, Regional Economic Development, and the Myth of Free Markets, is under contract with University of Texas Press.
Thanks, Brent, and thanks everybody else for participating in this. This is exciting. You know, lived in Austin for a long time, continue to write and research about Austin, and I'm really happy to get to talk to everybody about what's going on in Austin. So the way that I thought about this from my own research, kind of links environmental planning with racial injustice in Austin in the 20th century. So I kind of traced the way that environmental improvements and environmental ideologies exacerbated racial tension and exacerbated inequity, exacerbated geographic segregation within the city. Because my work is not directly related to policing, I thought that I would try to kind of broaden it out and think about police as a type of public investment in Austin, and to kind of demonstrate just very briefly for you some of the ways that public investment has always demonstrated inequity within Austin. So in general here, a few points to start off with. Investing more in police represents a choice in terms of how to allocate limited public resources. I think Monica brought that up as well, that, or it was Brent who talked about investing in police means disinvesting in other things. Public investment in Austin has almost always been used to either exacerbate racial difference and provide opportunities for white people while limiting opportunities for African Americans and other minorities. Minority voices have long been shut out in determining how to invest public resources. And I think that Prop A is a kind of good example of that historical tradition as well, from what I know of it. Public institutions have helped to facilitate those types of processes. And in my opinion, to redress historical inequities in public investment that have left minority communities on the socioeconomic and increasingly geographic margins of the city, it makes sense to incorporate their perspectives more when addressing public resource allocation. And I'll give you a few examples of this the history of the city is full of examples of this. I'm going to give three that all pertain to sort of federal resources being allocated locally. The first that I like to think about are water resources and environmental amenities. For most of us, or most people who live in Austin, the water system that's so precious to Austin's existence, and that Austin really couldn't exist without the water capture technologies that allow for the reservoirs. You see there an image of Mansfield Dam under construction in 1937, the Lower Colorado River Authority working with the federal government funded all of those dams and water capture technologies, allowing for Austin to have a lot more stability, to have a consistent source of water, cheap hydroelectric power, et cetera. But the way that those dams were implemented benefited almost exclusively people living in West Austin around the dams at the time, in terms of providing those resources and also in terms of allowing for all that land over there to become commodified and basically to increase in value. So what winds up happening is that the dams, while useful obviously for the city and allowing the city to grow, actually exacerbates racial difference. If you notice, the last in the series of dams is right at IH-35, which is historically the marking point between minority and white Austin. So improved on one side and sort of not improved on the other. Environmental amenities too. Barton Springs was long a segregated facility and also a facility that was invested in greatly to turn it from its natural existence as a springs into the pool that it is today. And the 1928 city plan, which many people discuss in Austin, there's about a page dedicated to what they call the Negro problem in there, and is about how to sort of segregate. What a lot of people don't know is that the 1928 plan was actually almost entirely an environmental plan. And the idea was to remove African-Americans and Mexican-Americans from West Austin in order to improve it. So it came along with the largest bond package in the city up until the 1950s. It was the largest bond package, and almost all of that was improving the areas where African-Americans and other minorities had been removed from. A second example would be in terms of housing. In the 1930s, the federal government implemented a plan, created the Homeowners Loan Corporation. And the Homeowners Loan Corporation, the purpose of it was to create residential security maps that basically told the federal government where to guarantee mortgages. So in order to kind of spur on the housing market during the Great Depression, and then again after World War II, the federal government decided to guarantee mortgages for realtors to obviously absorb some of the risks that mortgage lenders take in giving mortgages to allow people to buy homes. And the way that they did this was they had local realtors create maps to determine where to invest in and where not to, or where to guarantee these mortgages. And in Austin, as you see there, there are a few different red areas on the map. The maps are called redlining maps today because those red areas were areas where the federal government should not guarantee those mortgages. The largest section is the predominantly African-American section there, just to the east of what at the time was East Avenue. In the south, you have a predominantly Mexican-American neighborhood. And then in the western portions, all of those little neighborhoods in West Austin, there are also, at the time, were existing in small African-American colonies, most notably probably Clarksville, which maintained as an African-American area well into the 1970s. So what this program did was allow for cheap and guaranteed mortgages for white West Austinites, and really denied mortgages and led to depreciating property values among African-Americans and other minorities in the city. So another federal form of investment that exacerbates difference between white and non-white Austin. And then finally, in the 1950s and 1960s, urban renewal and the University of Texas. So urban renewal was a program where the federal government allocated funding to improve urban locations. This was a program that hundreds of cities took advantage of. And what wound up happening was the cities usually used the money to refurbish areas that they predominantly geared towards increasing capital accumulation, sort of at the expense of existing poor and oftentimes Black and brown communities. So in Austin, urban renewal funds were used for a few different things, but predominantly to expand the University of Texas campus. Actually, today on the east side of what's now IH-35. You can see I-35, the second deck being built there right in downtown Austin. The urban renewal funds were used to take via eminent domain land from people living in areas that were deemed slums. And my research found some maps. Elliot Treader has done some work on this too. My research found some maps where they were maps of the urban renewal areas where many of the homes and other structures within the urban renewal site were deemed fine by inspectors, and they were still destroyed as part of the urban renewal process. And it allows basically for UT to expand to the east to build what's today the athletic complex and the power plant over there east of IH-35. There were also a few other sites on the east side that were demolished and sort of redeveloped. The impact of this was essentially to displace about 1,000 residents of the east side, the vast majority of whom were non-white, and to further kind of segregate and further concentrate minorities in East Austin. So again, these three examples. There are many other examples. More modern examples happen on a more local level. Some things that I would point to are the siting of noxious industries in East Austin, zoning that Austin used. At first, Austin had for most of its history cumulative zoning. So on the east side, you had most of the east side was zoned to intensive uses. So you could have any kind of land use you wanted, right? Because the zoning was cumulative, meaning more intensive zoning, you could still have housing, for example, near heavy industry. So what you wind up with on the east side is this kind of haphazard array of homes and businesses and industry all sort of close together, which kept property values down. Where in West Austin, it was usually single-use zoning where there was differentiated land use between those places. This then changed in the 1990s and early 2000s to blanket zoning, which allowed for reinvestment in East Austin and was one of, to me, the drivers of early gentrification in that area. So what I call from containments in the earlier era to displacement in the later area. And then today, policies aimed at gentrification and higher levels of density in Austin have, I think, exacerbated gentrification and displacement of non-white people to the suburbs and to the periphery. Austin today, to my knowledge, is either the first or second lowest amount of African Americans of any major city in the United States. Only Portland is really even close with about 6.5% African Americans. How this has sort of played out today with these two maps, probably running out of time, but I'm looking forward to hearing from all the other panelists and yeah, excited to talk with everybody.
You're listening to excerpts from a UT event that was held this past week, titled Proposition A in the Context of Race and Policing in Austin, Texas, an Urgent Forum. We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to a special edition of Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on October 19th. We're listening to excerpts from a panel discussion that was held last week at UT titled Proposition A in the Context of Race and Policing in Austin, Texas, an Urgent Forum. The event was jointly sponsored by the UT Department of Religious Studies and the Institute for Historical Studies in the Department of History. And a quick programming note, Co-op will air additional coverage of this event on People United this Friday at 1 o'clock p.m. Let's pick up where we left off.
Next up, we have two representatives from Communities of Color United for Racial Justice. We have Gabriela Torres, who is a student at UT Austin and a community organizer. She is the daughter of two Mexican migrants and is originally from the Texas-Mexico border in the southernmost tip of Texas. She is a human rights advocate in southern Mexico and the U.S. and has been organizing for over 15 years. I guess I'll introduce Ashley after you go ahead and speak.
Thank you. Thank you so much for allowing us to share space with you. I'm Gabriela Torres. My pronouns are ella, she, her, hers, and I'm speaking from Sana, Tonkawa, and Coahuiltecan occupied territory, colonially known as Austin, Texas. At CCU, we are made up and organized with folks and community members that are mostly impacted by systemic inequality, power structures, and different kinds of violence. And I think it's very important to go back in history in order to understand where we are and how we got to this point. Like Monica mentioned, you know, since 2014, 2015, we as CCU have been advocating and pushing to move money around the annual city budget away from policing to permanently invest in our communities and their needs. Prop A, as we know it, is a direct backlash against this kind of community work and has been actively present for over 6 years now. The process of defunding the police was really amplified last summer when George Floyd was murdered by the police. And there was a lot of public attention and pressure, both locally and nationally. And here in Austin, from the Reimagining Public Safety Task Force was born, which was really an 8-month public participatory process between community members, organizers, and organizations, and the city. This task force worked to move millions of dollars from APD to instead invest in our community. And we gave the city a 75-page list of recommendations, primarily to divert funds from APD to community services such as healthcare, more clinics for substance use and recovery, COVID-19 care, mental health services, affordable and accessible housing, things like ending food security, financial assistance to victims and families of victims of police brutality and ICE deportation, and to also stop the collaboration between APD and ICE, for example, financial assistance to families hit by the pandemic and the recent winter storm from February. Just to give a little bit of context, last year, 40% of the city budget was given to APD, while only 7.9% was used for public housing and less than 1% for housing, for example. And so this year, as previously mentioned, APD's budget is $442 million. So it's the highest it's ever been in history. Prop A will require the city of Austin to add up to 800 more police officers on top of those that are already funded. And that will cost the city close to $120 million more per year. This will clearly force cuts to essential social services, and Prop A in reality really pushes us backwards from all the steps that we have made thus far. And so I want to be very honest. We believe that the only reason equity was ever on the city's agenda was because of the many years of grassroots efforts and unpaid work that really pressured the city, and also because of the national attention around the events that occurred last summer. And so this was really a public relations opportunity for the city of Austin. But what about deconstructing and rebuilding what people really need to be safe? What about all the Black and Brown lives that were murdered? What about the other mechanisms of policing and surveillance that exist, you know, individually and collectively and locally, statewide and nationally? It's not just about defunding the police. It's about, you know, how to organize and keep our communities safe and secure. And so there's a lot of misinformation going on around Prop A. The use of language around it makes it sound like a promising thing. And so we're here perhaps because you don't know that. And we're here to tell you that more police don't keep us safe. As organizers, we believe it's not just about voting, but really having meaningful conversations and inviting folks into our spaces to continue this work with each other and collectively talk about that shared vision that we have for ourselves and our families and our communities.
Thanks so much, Gabriela Torres. That was really helpful. Next up, we have Ashley Hamilton, also from Communities of Color United. Ashley Hamilton is a lifelong Austinite who has been working for her community for years. She is active in the work against Prop A and is coordinating a CCU community-based event for local Black families to learn more about Prop A that is happening this coming Saturday, which I believe you'll also announce. Thanks for being here.
Thank you guys for, one, I want to acknowledge this space and allowing us to be in the space again. My name is Ashley. I am also a community organizer with Communities of Color United. I am a single mother to two children. I work strongly with the Black and Brown community in which I grew up in, we're talking about the disparities that these communities experience. And I think one of the most important things to kind of reiterate is, one, allowing folks like myself to have a seat at the table to be able to open up these conversations and begin to bridge this work that needs to be done. We've been left out for so long, and we've been treated less than for so long that we're often overlooked. We're often go unheard. So to be able to be in a space right now where we're really talking about impacting change with the proposition that directly affects these Black and Brown communities is something that's near and dear to my heart and that I'm happy to speak about. I want to say that more importantly, when we're talking about Prop A and just what it really means and breaking it down, one of the reasons why I'm hosting that event is the lack of education around it. As my counterpart mentioned, the misinformation that has been used in regards to Prop A with the Save Austin Now campaign is really just a tactic to instill fear in these communities as if Austin isn't safe because of Black and Brown folks. Actually, when Austin is considered to be one of the safest cities in the United States, then starting to redirect in our thinking and understanding, are we now saying that it's not safe because of Black and Brown folks? Or who is it really safe for? Who are we really interested in protecting? Who are we prioritizing? Who needs that quote unquote safety? I'm so happy to be a part of an organization that prioritizes community, something that my family believes in and has been working diligently through our past generations, doing a lot of transformative justice work. We really believe in relying on one another. We don't feel like more police is the answer. Oftentimes we are scared to call the police, or you never know what the situation may be if the police come and show up. They're not coming to protect us. They're coming to protect property, property of which a lot of times Black and Brown folks do not own. Black and Brown folks are left out of. I think this is a much deeper conversation, which I'm glad that we are going to be exploring that today. And I'm just happy to get into the details of it. And so thank you guys for having me.
Thanks so much, Ashley Hamilton. Thanks for being here. Next up, we have Jason McDonald, who is an assistant professor of history at Truman State University, and he's the author of Racial Dynamics in Early 20th Century Austin. Thanks for being here, Professor McDonald.
Thank you for the invitation. I'm very happy to make a small contribution to this very important conversation. I was intrigued by the use of the two terms, racial justice and public safety, in framing this conversation. It's a few years since I've carried out research on Austin, Texas, so I kind of use those ideas to reformulate what my research means to me. First of all, in terms of trying to understand what those terms, racial justice and public safety, mean for white, Black, and Brown Austinites in the early 20th century, and also what that means in terms of the role of the Austin Police Department. For most of its history, the Austin Police Department's purpose was not to champion the cause of racial justice. Definitely not in terms of how we understand that concept. The Austin Police Force has been around for 159 years now. Only 67 of those years, less than two-fifths, have been in the period since the Brown versus Board of Education decision, which technically outlawed Jim Crow and segregation laws in the United States, and even less of their history has been since the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which that Brown decision was kind of attempts were made to enforce that in states like Texas. So for most of its history, it was an organization that existed under a regime in which racial justice was not the prime purpose of the state and the local authorities. For most of its history, therefore, one of its main purposes was actually to enforce racist state laws and racist local ordinances. From the 1830s onwards, Texas had anti-miscegenation laws, which banned intermarriage between whites and blacks. The local police force, its job was to enforce that racist law. And those laws weren't abolished in Texas until 1969, 2 years after the Supreme Court. So that was one of the racist laws that the APD, its job was to enforce that law. There were segregated transportation laws in Texas and Austin. In 1891, the state of Texas said that railroad cars should be segregated. In 1906, Austin passed a city ordinance saying that streetcars should be segregated. The Austin Police Force, its job was to enforce those laws, and it did. There were segregated public facilities across Austin, water fountains, parks, and the Austin Police Force, its job was to make sure that they stayed segregated. In the case of water fountains, they were quite brutal in the way that they enforced those. Austin Police Department has played a major role in defending white supremacy. And that role had major ramifications for what public safety meant for whites compared to black and brown residents of Austin. The Austin Police Department engendered feelings of safety among the whites because it offered them protection to person and protection to property. But the Austin Police Department, for most of its history, aroused mistrust and fear in the black and the brown populations because it served as the frontline enforcers of racist customs and laws. It was brutal in the way that it enforced Jim Crow laws. People, for example, numerous examples I cited in my research of local policemen beating up African-Americans if they tried to use water fountains that were listed as whites only and taking pride in the fact that they used violence to enforce those. And also this concept of public safety. One example in the early 20th century of an African-American who was called onto the witness stand in a court in Austin. And when he was answering questions, the prosecutor's name was Dan Moody. Any of you know anything about the history of Texas? Dan Moody, after being prosecutor, later served as the governor of the whole state of Texas. Prosecutor Dan Moody picked up a chair and hit the black witness with the chair in the courthouse. So public safety meant something very different to African Americans in Austin than it did to whites. Whites would not expect to be physically attacked in a courtroom in Texas by a state prosecutor and someone who ends up being the governor of Texas. For most of its history, therefore, the Austin Police Department was actually the public face of racial injustice. The current motto of the Austin Police Department is "One Austin, safer together." That motto could not have been less reflective of what the pre-civil rights era Austin Police Department's role was. A better motto for that earlier period would have been something like "Many Austins, unsafe and apart." Local law enforcers vigorously suppressed the nascent racial justice movement. When the NAACP was first organizing itself in Austin, Texas, in the wake of the First World War, the local law enforcers took a role in suppressing that organization. It was not just enforcing laws, it was suppressing protest movements. In terms of thinking about racial justice and public safety, if you think of what it was like to be African-American in Austin in the early 20th century, and think of the role of the police and what that meant for racial justice and public safety, the police banned publications that they thought bore dangerous political messages. The NAACP's magazine Crisis, for example, was banned. The police disbanded organizations that protested against Jim Crow laws and other inequalities. So it disbanded organizations, the NAACP. The police literally chased people out of town, and it prohibited free speech and assembly. Those are all constitutional rights that every single American takes for granted, and all white Americans in Austin could take that for granted. But African Americans, they lived in a police state. Imagine what it was like. It was more like a police state than living in the land of the free. The Austin Police Department played a principal role in creating that police state situation. How easy is it for an institution that for most of its history worked to defend racial injustice and undermine the sense of safety of persons of color? How easy is it for that kind of institution to transform itself into one that advances racial justice and holds a more inclusive conception of public safety? Indeed, is it actually at all possible for an institution with a history like the Austin Police Department to even undergo this transformation?
Thanks so much, Professor McDonald. And we have Elliot Treader, our final panelist. He's faculty at the University of Calgary and research fellow in geography at UT Austin. And he's also author of the book Shadows of a Sunbelt City, The Environment, Racism, and the Knowledge Economy in Austin.
Thanks. And it's really great to be here and listening to everybody and listening to these great work that's being done and to oppose this. Before I start, I'd just like to say that in the spirit of reconciliation, that I'd like to acknowledge that I live and work and play on the traditional territories of the Blackfoot Confederacy. This kind of contains the Siksika, the Kainai, and the Piikani peoples, the Tsuut'ina, and the Stoney Nakoda, the traditional lands of the Métis people in Region 3. All of the peoples that I live around are contained by the Treaty 7 region of Southern Alberta. And I'm always remembered of that. And when I think about the police, I always think about Lamar's campaigns and the use of the police and the origins of the Texas Rangers and the origins of the police in the genocidal campaign in Texas. So to go back to that and to go back to the origins of the state police to understand the history of that genocide. I just wanted to talk briefly some things that I was responding to here. I've written about before. One thing I had noted was about the kind of role, the discussion around the quality of life, kind of animating force in the development of Austin in the 1980s and 90s, slightly more present than what the authors, their conversation was going. And there was a lot of discussion, this sort of importance of environmental and social conditions in the rise of the city. In one paper I wrote a long time ago, I identified policing as a feature of the rebirth or the redevelopment of Austin, particularly zero tolerance or what's called quality of life policing. And the idea was that the central city in Austin, the downtown, had this kind of image associated with crime, zero tolerance. And there was a kind of effort to establish a private security force and to particularly to target houseless people living downtown. This is a continual kind of development. So that the last campaign is sort of more or less reminiscent of this. And the business organizations at this time were effective at both sort of fighting with what they viewed as very lenient judges. And they supported the passage of what became what was known as the camping ban. Now, what's interesting is, of course, that the camping ban was subsequently repealed by the city council with kind of the leadership of some people like Greg Saar. And it was repealed. And then, of course, then it was retroactive or later sort of put it back into place. Just to really note the centrality of policing as a strategy in the urban revitalization efforts there in the 80s and 90s. And this is kind of a what ZTP or zero tolerance policing kind of has as a kind of idea, sort of small infractions and the ideas that sort of lax policing called broken windows thesis sort of results in misdemeanors. And this kind of arrest that decline and to kind of use policing as a strategy. So I'm going to just stop there. Thanks a lot.
Great. Thanks so much. It's been a really wonderful conversation. Thank you all for coming and sharing your knowledge and wisdom with us. And thanks to Courtney for organizing this. Thanks, everybody.
Well, it's Friday afternoon, October 22nd, and once again, we have Austin Sanders with us. How are you doing this warm afternoon, Austin?
I'm doing all right. Thanks for having me on, Bob.
Prop A continues to heat up. What's the latest?
The headline there is the EMS Association made the decision to formally oppose Prop A. Again, this is the local ballot measure to set a static staffing level for police officers based on population size, 2 officers for every 1,000 residents, among some other changes to the department. The EMS union had initially wanted to stay out of this fight. You know, there's a lot of reasons why that would be the case. One thing I pointed out in my story was that they share legal representation with the combined law enforcement associations of Texas, known as CLEAT. At the Capitol, it's a really powerful lobby for law enforcement interests. And it's a pretty notable step for the EMS Association to publicly oppose Proposition A. Of course, that means they joined the Austin Firefighters Association and AFSCME Local 1624, which represents the civilian employees at the city. So basically what we have here is virtually all city employees, except for, you know, the police officers, of course, which should be noted, they make up about 10% of the city's 13,500 person workforce. So a sizable bunch. But the associations that represent virtually every other employee have now lined up to oppose this measure, which again, I think really speaks to the financial threat that it would pose to other services if passed. And indeed, Selena C., the president of the EMS Association, pointed to that very issue when talking about the decision to oppose. You know, she said that EMS as a city department has really struggled to get small $1 to $5 million enhancements to EMS. And we're talking about Proposition A requiring an investment between $50 or more than $100 million a year into the police department. So the EMS union kind of is taking the same line that the firefighters union has taken, which is that this is not about pitting public safety agencies against one another. It's not any attack on law enforcement or police officers. It's just the reality of how budgets work. If the city has to invest all of this money into the police department, the only way they can do that is by raising property taxes through an election or cutting services to other departments. And fire, EMS, these are two of the biggest departments in the city's budget, so they would be likely candidates, along with the parks and library departments, which are also some of the largest expenditures within the city's budget.
So speaking of APD, it sounds like city council got a briefing about the police academy.
Yeah, so last summer when council adopted the budget in 2020, part of that budget included taking funding away for cadet classes at the police academy for at least two classes. This past March, council voted to restart the academy, the understanding that the department would work with the Office of Police Oversight, the equity offices, others at the city, as well as a third-party consultant, Crowland Associates, to reimagine the police academy, as the city staff has called it, to basically implement a suite of reforms aimed at improving the instructional quality at the police academy, kind of moving away from this paramilitary teaching style that instilled a warrior mindset in police officers. The first new academy, the 144th cadet class, began in June, and they've been meeting, you know, every day since then. And Kroll and Associates provided a briefing to council at their Thursday, October 21st meeting, presenting an 80-page report that they wrote offering an update on progress to overhaul the academy. And there's definitely some improvements they've made. They have new community engagement requirements that gets cadets out in the community interacting with a variety of people they'll be serving and protecting. They've done away with some of the stress-based exercises that ended up hospitalizing former cadets and being the reason that some dropped out of the academy. But in the report, the consultants write, quoting here, "Overall, however, the military-style culture still prevails in the academy, with an emphasis on disciplinary measures and collective accountability." And this military-style culture is kind of the big problem with the academy. Again, in prior internal and external reports looking into the academy culture have concluded that this approach to teaching cadets produces officers who go into each shift as if they were entering a battle. And the civilians, the residents that they are sworn to protect, are enemy combatants. It's this kind of approach that is really problematic and troubling, which the consultants acknowledge there's no way you could do away with all of that within the first 15 weeks of an academy. So it's kind of going to be an iterative process where they're going to have to keep the department, the city, perhaps this consultant will have to continue working on reforming the academy through the rest of this class, the next cadet class, which, you know, Chief Joseph Chacon really wants to have meet in February. The 144th class, the current class, graduates in January. So the report kind of showed us that reform has not been accomplished yet. It's still very much a work in progress. There are some positive signs to point to show that reform is happening, but still many more steps to go before that can be considered accomplished. One thing that really, I think, drew the attention of council members and staff was a cadet survey. 54% of cadets said that they had heard academy instructors basically ridiculing this idea of reimagining the police academy, which really, you know, kind of calls into question how serious the academy staff is about undertaking this reform effort. I think that was a big concern for council members who really pressed the chief to ensure that was not going to be a barrier to reform. And the chief responded, he's aware of that. He was troubled by that survey result as well. And he's working on a plan over the next 3 to 5 years to really ensure that all training staff is fully on board with this idea of reimagining the police academy.
Well, it sounds like it's a work in progress. As always, thanks so much for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thanks again for having me on, Bob.
That's all for tonight. Don't forget to tune in to People United on Friday at 1 o'clock p.m. for more coverage of the UT Forum. Good night, everyone. Stay safe.